Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Happy Tax Day, Ken.
Thank you. Do not tread on me, by the way.
Let's just say this is the perfect day to talk about the American Tea Party system.
We're recording this on Thursday, April 15th, which happens to be Tax Day. I think the Tea Party was involved in something to do with Boston in 1773.
And also something in Boston 2010. They had a Sarah Palin starring rally in Boston on April 14th. And today they're in Washington, D.C. They're down in Florida at Cape Canaveral, where the president is talking, and they're protesting him. And they're also, to some degree, protesting the elimination of some NASA jobs because of cutbacks at NASA. And they're in many, 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 many different locales around the country, rallying against taxation and against the health care bill and against, well, pretty much the entire Obama program.
Well, you know that once they get rid of NASA, then you get Sadat. That was a great joke in the 60s.
That's the worst joke you have ever tried to tell.
Really?
The Tea Party is topping page one of the New York Times. Why is the New York Times so interested in the Tea Party?
Well, I think everybody's interested in the Tea Party because we don't know. First of all, I think their role, their influence may have been exaggerated, or certainly it was heralded during on January 19th when Scott Brown, the so-called darling of the Tea Party, although he's not voting the way the Tea Party would like, Scott Brown was elected in Massachusetts. So the Tea Party has its influence, and every Democrat in the country was endangered. Daniel Inouye, Barbara Boxer, every Democrat who's running had to fear the wrath of the Tea Party. What surprised me, though, is that the demographics of the Tea Party supporters are not that much different than a majority of the American public.
Well, they are not really the typical American. They are better off than the typical American.
Are.
And they're a little bit more established, a little bit more establishment, which is not necessarily the image the Tea Party has cultivated. It has cultivated much more of a populist, up from the base of society
less
kind of
educated.
Image.
Would you agree that?
Well, that is the caricature. Now, maybe that's
right.
Been put on them by the media, by people like you and me, Ken, but at the same time, they have cultivated an image of being the little guy, not necessarily the person of privilege, not necessarily the more comfortable of society. How do you explain that discrepancy?
Well, I don't know, and that's a very good question. Either it's a media characterization or it's the fact that people will focus at some of the more outlandish things you hear at rallies.
And see
at rallies. And of course, those were really happened. It's not that we made them up. The epithets, the yelling, the signs were real, but do they represent what the majority of the Tea Party supporters, and maybe they don't.
See, that's the key word, I think, here is supporters. And it's very clear in the Times that they are surveying here people who say they're in sympathy with the Tea Party. There's a much, much smaller percentage. 18%
right.
Say they support the Tea Party. Only 4% say they have either given money to a Tea Party candidate or cause or shown up at an event, which could mean many different things. And the particular kinds of events that have gotten all the media attention are the ones with the signs and the masks and the nastiness. And those events probably have only attracted some smaller fraction of even that 4%. So it's rather, I suppose, misleading to focus on the visual elements of those rallies and think that's what the Tea Party is. It seems to me the Tea Party is really just another way of saying the more intensely involved conservative.
Yes, and certainly more conservative than the normal Republican. But if you're looking for some place where it may play out, you don't have to go any further than Kentucky in May 18th. Once upon a time, when Jim Bunning was forced out of the race.
He was the senator there for one term.
Two terms. Senator, and he was forced out because, one, his polling numbers stunk, and he wasn't raising any money, and he was at odds with everybody in the Republican Party establishment in Kentucky, certainly Mitch McConnell. So they forced him out.
Mitch McConnell being the other senator from Kentucky
right.
And the Republican leader in the Senate.
That's right. And they brought in Trey Grayson, solid conservative, I mean, an unabashed conservative, the Secretary of State, and he was going to be the establishment choice, a conservative establishment, nonetheless, to run for the Senate to replace
Jim
Bunning.
Yeah, no problem there.
And he was going to clearly win the nomination. It was clearly that Mitch McConnell pushed Bunning out, but Trey Grayson was very solicitous of Bunning.
Being used, though, by Mitch McConnell
perhaps, to,
if you will, muscle Jim Bunning out.
But it's very possible that Trey Grayson is the latest Charlie Crist in that choice of the establishment, huge polling numbers in the beginning.
Shoo-in. Everybody thought he was given the Senate seat.
And now, with about a month or so to go before the May 18th primary, you have Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, an ophthalmologist from
Rand, Poland, son of Ron.
Who also has raised a ton of money through the internet, as his dad did. But unlike his dad, who didn't make a dent in his battle for the Republican nomination, Rand Paul has a clear lead in every poll for the Senate race in Kentucky.
So this could be the first case of the Tea Party clearly taking a nomination away from the more conventional Republican Party. And I'm wondering here if, at this juncture, we're not seeing some evidence that the greater impact of the Tea Party is going to be on the conservative side of the political spectrum. In other words, not so much taking seats away from Democrats, although they may well do that, and perhaps did in some measure in Massachusetts, but within the Republican Party, replacing the candidates of the establishment with people who come from somewhere else. Now, Rand Paul had some basis on which to run before there was ever a
Tea Party. Well, he was interested in politics. We don't know if he was interested in a career, but because his name is Rand Paul, and because the establishment lined up behind another candidate, that set the Tea Party people off, and they just said that's not acceptable.
So the interesting thing, though, is that here again, we're portraying the Tea Party as being a populist alternative to establishment Republicans, but what we're learning is that people who call themselves Tea Party supporters are pretty much describable as the essence of conventional conservative Republicans.
Well, look, if it were Barry Goldwater versus Nelson Rockefeller, there's obviously no choice for conservatives. But Trey Grayson is a conservative. There are a lot of other conservatives. John McCain, some people would describe, and I would describe, is a conservative, but perhaps not conservative enough for some people like the Tea Party people. And they'll back the J.D. Hayworths or the Rand Pauls and states like that. So the question is this a plus or a minus for the Republican Party? It will excite the base. It will bring out perhaps new voters to the whole process. But does it scare off centrists and moderates for November? That's the question.
That's a question for November. But even in the shorter term, I think there's a real question mark over what exactly is going on here and whether it's a contest between different kinds of Republicans ideologically or different kinds of Republicans demographically, if it's a competition for the most conservative votes within the Republican spectrum or within the conservative spectrum. That, it seems to me, for the moment, is changing the nature of the Republican Party and to some degree changing the nature of the way their elected representatives behave in Washington. Mitch McConnell and some of the other Republican leaders have come out saying a number of things about, let's say, for example, the Wall Street re-regulation bill that is poised to come to the Senate floor if the two parties can muster 60 votes between them. They've come out saying things about that bill that are clearly influenced by a desire to speak to the Tea Party. They have said that the bill constitutes bailouts for big Wall Street
love that word.
Banks and that it's all going to be on the taxpayer. And they're not really referencing the bill itself. What they're referencing is a caricature of the bill that largely comes from the Tea Party.
Yes, that's true. But the fact is that both parties in this battle over financial deregulation are fighting over whether it's Main Street versus Wall Street. And, you know, we're not going to be the party of Wall Street.
But this is Mitch McConnell talking.
Right.
And he took over $1 million in the last electoral cycle where he was last reelected from essentially the banking industry.
Yeah, well, candidates of both parties are taking money from the financial
No question about it. But here's the question. If one party takes money from the banking industry and the other party takes money from the banking industry, and one party says, we need to regulate that industry, we need to have a consumer protection agency to regulate that industry, we have to do all these other things, and the other party says, no, we don't, who are the friends of the banking industry?
Well, exactly, and that's exactly why I think this whole debate plays into the Democratic hands of portraying the Republican Party as tools of bankers and Wall Street interests, and that's why I suspect that it may not be that difficult for Democrats to get 60 votes. I'm not sure if the language that we see now in this bill will be as it will be when they finally vote on it, but ultimately I think the Democrats get the 60 because this is an easy issue to play politically.
All right, let's talk about some of the deconstruction going on in the Democratic base, and maybe that's the wrong way to characterize this, but there is at least a lot of ferment going on in the fastest growing union that has been the most politically active union, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and their president, the hard-driving, hard-charging Andy Stern, decided to step down this week.
Well, you know, at first, my first reaction was, what a surprise. He's at the top of his game. He helped elect President Obama. They spent like $65, $70 million on behalf of that effort, probably the most politically active unions of all the unions. The culmination of the health care bill that passed was also something that Andy Stern has fought for. Remember, he threatened Democratic primary challenges to Democrats who took SEIU money and yet voted no. So he was very, very active. And boom, suddenly he says, okay, I'm 59 years old. I've had enough.
I'm done.
I mean, George Meany was 160 when he left, I think, the AFL-CIO, something like that.
Certainly 150.
In the shade. So anyway, it seemed like a young age for somebody of that significance to be leaving. And yet, now that he's leaving, now that he's announced he's leaving, there are more and more people coming out of the labor woodwork who said that really he was not the great savior we hoped he'd be when he pulled the SEIU out of the AFL-CIO in 2005 and formed Change to Win with the Teamsters and a few other unions. That was going to be a great federation that was going to make a big difference. Ultimately, it didn't make that much of a difference. I think anything was responsible for Barack Obama being elected in 2008, mostly George W. Bush. So I don't know if labor had the kind of pull it had in the past. He's had family feuds with some local unions in California that turned off a lot of his supporters. I think a lot of people feel that he is not the face of the future of the union movement, and he read the tea leaves.
So a good day for Richard Tremka, the president of AFL-CIO, who had seen Andy Stern, obviously, as a rival organization, as a rival individual, as a rival for the spotlight in the labor movement?
I think so. I mean, again, there are fewer and fewer people joining unions. There are fewer and fewer people contributing to union political action committees. They still didn't get the card check, which they were still hoping to get, as Democrats are nervous about that. Like
card check, this is the bill that makes it easier for people to unionize.
Right, the employee free choice, right thing. And Blanche Lincoln is one of those Democrats who say, well, I'm not sure this is the way to go. So even Democrats are not completely on board. A stronger union, a more powerful union, perhaps, would make sure that the Democrats spoke in a united voice on that.
Before we leave Washington to talk about some of the states around the country that you love so well,
there are like 50 of them, right?
The Supreme Court is down one as of this summer when John Paul Stevens retires. The president is mulling his options. There's been some speculation that the president really knows perfectly well who he wants to choose. It's Elena Kagan, and he's just playing this little game of consulting with lots of people and making sure everyone's ego has been stroked and that lots of other candidates have gotten mentioned so that they will feel better.
I don't know if it's Elena Kagan, but I do sense that those who were on the short list when Sonia Sotomayor was picked last year are still on that short list. Elena Kagan, Merrick Garland, Diane Wood, the two federal appeals judges in Washington and Chicago.
And Chicago, respectively.
Respectively.
And we want it always be respectively when we're talking
Washington,
federal judges.
Chicago. Yes. So anyway, so I think it's one of the three. But then they keep throwing out names like Janet Napolitano, that I think they should throw out her name because I don't think it'll be her. I don't think it'll be Jennifer Granholm either. But there are others.
And the White House has said it won't be Hillary Clinton because that name always does come up.
Right.
She's going to stay as Secretary of State.
Well, look, I think the blogosphere would love talking about Hillary Clinton now on the Supreme Court, and perhaps that's something she would love to see one day. But I think most Americans, certainly the White House, feels she's doing a great job as Secretary of State. And the last poll I saw, as a matter of fact, people give her a higher rating than the President Obama.
Although, wouldn't be surprised at
all. I think Ron Elving has a higher rating
Obama. At least among the people in those polls. Okay, I'm going to throw out a wild speculation here, and just clearly this is nothing but wild speculation, but I think Obama not only knew he wanted to go with Sonia Sotomayor a year ago, but he knew
from the beginning,
and he knew that he would then go to Elena Kagan second, and that he will hold off on Merrick Garland, who has a lot of Republican fans, until the Senate is much more closely contested, and he would get the third pick, if there is a third pick, and I think he goes to Hillary Clinton with his fourth. If he should be president so long as to have a fourth, he goes to Hillary Clinton.
There are so many things to touch upon there. I like the idea that basically the plan all along was Sotomayor and then Kagan, because that's exactly what Bill Clinton did with a retirement in 1993. He picked Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer was on the shortlist, and right away, in the next opportunity, Stephen Breyer got that nomination as well. Kagan is a possibility. She doesn't have the kind of paper trail that Diane Wood does.
Particularly on abortion.
On abortion, right, exactly. And I think that makes sense. Merrick Garland has had more support with the Republicans, and assuming 2010 is a good Republican year with more Republicans in the Senate, he might go that way. I still don't think Hillary Clinton is on that list at all, but it's something to talk about.
If Barack Obama were to get, say, in a second term, a fourth choice, I believe it will be Hillary Clinton, but we can return to that.
Do you think Robert Bork is finished?
Somewhere in the future.
In the states, the news of the week is that a special congressional election in Florida's 19th congressional district around Boca Raton, West Palm Beach. Robert Wexler resigned this January after seven terms to head up this Middle East think tank, and Ted Deutsch, state senator backed by Wexler, overwhelmingly won that seat. It was not a close race, although the Republican there hope to use the passage of the health care bill to get seniors riled up. And also, he also said there are a lot of Jewish residents in the 19th district, and he was trying to make the case that since Barack Obama sold out Israel, can you trust the Democrats anymore? Anyway, that ploy didn't work at all, and Ted Deutch won easily.
This was not the district in which to test the appeal of the Republican pitch for this fall. This was a district the Democrats could scarcely lose, and so the real competition was...
I agree. And Ed Lynch, who's the Republican, ran against Wexler 2 years ago and got like 25% of the vote, so he was not about to win this one. But there are still four other open seats. Nathan Deal in Georgia. We have the Eric Massa seat in New York. We have the John Murtha seat in Pennsylvania. And we have the Neil Abercrombie seat in Hawaii. Three of those will be decided in May. We still don't have a date for the Eric Massa seat.
Now, usually you would say the Georgia seat, the Nathan Deal seat, would
be safe Republican.
Right. And Hawaii, the same for the Democrat, but not this year.
No, because it's a special election when all the candidates were on the same ballot and there were two Democrats in the Hawaii race beating each other up, and there's hope for the Republican candidate, a Honolulu city councilman. He might win it. Republicans are hopeful of it. I still think the Democrats hold on to that seat.
But New York and Pennsylvania, these have been held by Democrats for a short period of time in the Massa case in New York, for a very long period of time, of course, with the late John Murtha's seat in Pennsylvania. But both of those, excellent chances for the Republicans to flex their muscles for 2010.
Certainly in the Massa seat, and I think that's one of the reasons David Paterson is not calling a special election, because he thinks the Republicans will win that seat. And I think they will. It's a tough one in Pennsylvania. It's a Democratic majority seat, but it's culturally conservative. Remember, John Murtha called them racist, the folks in the 12th district in Pennsylvania. So there is a culturally conservative, socially conservative element in that district that could help the Republicans. Probably a toss-up.
While we're in New York, Ken, a couple of other things going on there. A new candidate running for governor and a new candidate running against Charlie Rangel.
Well, on the latter thing, it's kind of a new candidate. It's certainly an old name. Adam Clayton Powell IV, whose father, Adam Clayton Powell, was defeated by Charles Rangel in 1970.
Now, his father was Adam Clayton Powell Jr.
So Rangel's been there for 40 years now. Adam Clayton Powell IV did run against Rangel in 1994 and got clobbered. However, this is a different Charlie Rangel. He's been admonished by the House Ethics Committee. He's under further scrutiny on his...
He's stepped down as chairman of Ways and Means.
Forced
and
out.
Powell has been very explicit about saying, hey, sure, he had clout before, but he doesn't have that kind of clout anymore.
And Harlem is not the same as it was in 1970. It's more white, it's more Hispanic, it's less African-American. And Adam Clayton Powell, who is also is part Latino... I don't know if he can beat Rangel, but he certainly has a better shot now than he did certainly in 94.
It's a contest, and he's a contender. Can we say the same for Carl Palladino?
Oh, my goodness. Carl Palladino is a multimillionaire developer from Buffalo who was going to be the Tea Party candidate for governor of New York as a Republican. If he didn't get the Republican nomination, he was going to run as a Tea Party independent. He certainly had the money. He certainly had the kind of moxie to do it. And then suddenly...
He had the moxie.
But he also had he didn't have the brains, and I'll tell you what part the brains come in, or lack of same, he forwarded explicitly racist, sexist, misogynist emails and videos to friends of his, and he defended himself by saying, look, you know, we hear these political incorrect things all the time. The thing is, you don't do it if you hope to get to run for political office, let alone governor of New York. So for all the talk about how these Tea Party candidates are going to really do well, and many Tea Party candidates will do well, Carl Palladino will not be among them.
Two last things. We said last week Tommy Thompson might be taking a look and might have a lead over Russ Feingold in Wisconsin. Tommy Thompson, the 4 times elected governor and former member of the Bush cabinet. Tommy Thompson has apparently decided not to run. And one final point. I saw a wonderful bumper sticker I think is worth noting this week. We can think about what it may mean. It was a lovely bumper sticker on the back of an SUV here in Washington, D.C. It said Reagan 2012.
But of course he couldn't run because he's already served 2 terms.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Hey, Ronald Reagan, living large in hearts of men. Hey, Ronald Reagan,